welcome back to the Chris Yeh podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh, and I am here on location, as it were, at the Modern Elder Academy in Baja, California, an amazing place created, or co-created rather, because many other people are involved, by my friend Chip Conley, who is also a member of the Silicon Guild. We, the Silicon Guild, are here in Baja, California, for a week-long retreat, thinking about things like the future of publishing, writing in AI, and also really looking deep within ourselves. And it is in that context that I'm so delighted to be joined today by my dear friend and fellow Silicon Guild member, Whitney Johnson. Whitney, of course, is a legendary author, management thinker, protege of the legendary Clay Christensen. She has continued to push forward the notion of disruption in helping honor Clay's legacy. She's just an amazing person. And Whitney, thank you for getting up early and joining me today.
Chris, thank you for having me. And it is really fun to be here and have this conversation with you.
What's really interesting, folks, is this is one of those rare podcasts that's actually being recorded in person. So we are physically together looking at each other, which is so unusual. Normally, it's just like a Zoom screen or something. So I'm actually curious. It's been so long. I wonder if it'll be any different.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, yeah, I'd say probably, 98% of the podcast interviews that I've done, either being interviewed or interviewing, have been over Zoom. And that works really, really well.
Absolutely.
But there is something about the physicality of being in the same room. It's very powerful.
And that is one of the things we're trying to learn at the Modern Elder Academy. As writers, we are very often intellectual. We live in the world of the head. And here we are balancing that by doing some of the work of the heart as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's been very moving.
It has.
But, you know, one of the things that you said earlier this week that was very moving is you spoke about something that oftentimes in this particular world we inhabit, we don't talk about as much, even though it used to be something that was central to everyone, which is your faith. And I thought we would explore it a little bit today because, again, it's not something you hide. There's nothing that either of us has to hide. But it's not a topic that often comes up. So tell me about your faith. You are a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, yes?
Yes, I am.
How did it begin? Like, obviously, you're born into the faith. Mm-hmm. Tell me about where you grew up and what it was like growing up in the faith.
Yeah, so I actually grew up in San Jose, California. Now we know it as Silicon Valley. And interestingly enough, I was and I was not born into the faith. So my dad was not a member of this church. He joined the church when I was 5 years old. My mother came from a long line of pioneers. In fact, my second great-grandfather is Ebenezer Bryce, after whom Bryce Canyon is named.
Wow.
So that's fun. And so my mother at the time when they got married was not part of the faith, but after she had children, as oftentimes happens, people think, oh, I want to, what's going to be the moral center or grounding for my children? And funnily enough, my sister and I were going to a preschool. It was called the Challenger Preschool, and we would come home singing songs like, I looked out the window and what did I see? Popcorn popping on the apricot tree. And that turned out to be a song that we would sing in primary. Mm-hmm. And that sparked something in my mom of, let's go back to church. Mm-hmm. So I actually started going to this particular church when I was 3 or 4 years old.
And your mother had grown up in the faith and
she had
left it.
She had. She'd grown up, and then when she went to college, she left. And then when my sister and I were young, she started going back to church.
You know, it's a beautiful story because I'm thinking about all the different threads. You know, the fact that your sister and you sort of brought her back to this, and also that your father joined her in
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I, you know, we in San Jose in the I would say in the 60s and the 70s, and I think in the world generally, it wasn't. Most people believed in God. I remember having conversations with people, what religion are you, you know? But I also remember from a very young age, people would tease me because of my faith. You know, oh, she's more than a man, she's a more man, you know, kind of thing.
That's
you know, as only 8 and 9 year olds can do. And so I remember feeling at a pretty young age of, yes, I am a person of faith, but there was ridicule that came mm-hmm. from a pretty young age of because of my particular faith.
Did the ridicule, obviously the ridicule never feels good, but did the ridicule cause you to change the way you interacted with your faith?
Yes, I think it did, in the sense that it toughened me up on the one hand of like, do I believe this or not? And, you know, as a child, and then I went on a mission to Uruguay for a year and a half. And so I learned Spanish, and that was something that I chose to do and I wanted to do. But I do remember when I first started working on Wall Street, people would say, you know, typically, hey, everybody's going to go out for a beer. And I didn't drink a beer. Right. And they're like, why aren't you drinking? And then, you know, within like 5 minutes, and it comes up what faith I am.
Right.
But because of those early scars as a child, there was a little bit of a sense of going underground. And there was a really interesting article that came out when Mitt Romney was running for president. It was... don't remember the name of the actual person who wrote it, but it was in the New York Times, and he wrote this op-ed, and he was talking about how members of the Church of Jesus Christ had done this really interesting thing, which is over the course of one century mm-hmm. had gone from being murdered outcasts,
yes.
which we were,
yes.
to being Harry Reid, to running for president.
Right.
But what they said is the way we had done that was by mainstreaming and by never talking about what we actually believe. And so we had learned to hide. We learned to hide. And so at the same time, we've had over the last 3 or 4 decades where religion in general has gone underground, we had already gone underground in order to assimilate, in order to protect ourselves.
That is really interesting. I also think that it ties in with what I jokingly call, hopefully this is not offensive, what I call the fundamental business model of the church. Because one of the things that is important in any business model is distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And the key to the distribution of the faith, in this case, is the mission, which
mm-hmm.
you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And by concentrating the proselytizing in the mission, it meant that you as a member of the church and other members of the church could go through their everyday lives not talking about, not spreading the faith, because there was this concentrated effort that you put in. It's almost as if you were investing a lump sum up front and letting it compound over time.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's very interesting. And I have often compared, and probably unfairly so, but, you know, serving a mission in our church is not unlike, it's like the spiritual version of the Israeli service, or even the Korean army. And
Absolutely.
So, and I had never thought of that. And I do think sometimes there is that tendency of like, well, I did my work. I did my time.
Mm-hmm.
I served for a year and a half. I served for 2 years. Now I'm done. Now, what we now know though today is that people are not necessarily, they don't like people knocking on their doors. None of us do.
No.
And so that has caused this shift of, okay, we have to stop hiding if we care about what we believe, because if we continue to hide, then no one will know this wonderful thing that we believe.
And one of the things that has been a theme of this week is the importance of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking before about nothing to hide and everything like that, but I think it's very true that secrets, even if they are kept for good reasons,
mm-hmm.
there's inevitably a fallout. There's a cost to keeping secrets
mm-hmm.
from people that you care about, from people that you interact with, from people that you want to have a relationship
mm-hmm.
with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what was interesting...
I don't know what that is. Is that the bees?
Yeah. Is that going to be okay for
now? I think it'll be fine.
Okay.
I'm just fascinated by that.
Okay.
So, folks, I think what we might be hearing is a swarm of bees outside the window of this office. And, yeah.
Oh, because they're not in here, are they?
They're not in here. They're outside.
Oh, fascinating. Okay, the bees are buzzing. They're curious what we have to say as well.
And they're drawn into the honey of our words.
The nectar. yeah, so I think two thoughts are coming to me. So one is a person that was a big role model for me, as you mentioned, is Clay Christensen. Yes. I had the privilege, and I truly consider it a privilege, of connecting with him in a slightly unusual way. It was back in 2004. I heard him speak in church, and I was absolutely captivated by this giant of a man and his storytelling, and just there was so much gravitas to everything he'd said. And so I started to discover his work and applied it to my work on Wall Street, and then had this big epiphany of disruption it's not about companies, it's about people. But then I, in one of those sort of burn the bridges, left my job on Wall Street, became an entrepreneur, and I think secretly wanted to work with Clay. And so I ended up working with him in public affairs for our church. And when he wanted to start a fund, he and his son wanted to start a fund, the Disruptive Innovation Fund, because I had worked on Wall Street. He asked me to join him.
You were a logical
choice. It was a logical choice. He knew how I worked, and so I got to do that for 5 years. But what I want to share with you is, for anybody who knows him, there are many things that you could have learned from Clay.
Right.
And I learned many. But the one that has stayed with me is that he did not separate the secular from the spiritual. He didn't.
Right.
He didn't. He was bold. Yes. He was bold in bringing his intellectual prowess and into his church life.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he was bold in bringing his spiritual life to work. He had on his website Why I Believe. And so that was something that I think about his legacy to me. The most important thing has been, how do I not compartmentalize? How do I show up and bring the secular to the spiritual and the spiritual to the secular? And so with that as a backdrop, the other night we had this activity of getting to know each other. And it was that if you really knew me, you would know this about me. And you know, I thought about it. There's many things that I could say, and I think there are many things that many of us could say about, you know, the experiences that we've had, et cetera. But for me, when I think about identity, what's the most important piece of my identity, who I am, how do I configure myself in this world of believing that I am a daughter of God, I'm a Christian? I said, if you really knew me, you would know that I love God. I love God. I love Jesus Christ. And that was difficult for me to say.
Yeah.
Now, you'll notice that I didn't start with what church I'm a member of.
No, because that is secondary to the primary.
Exactly. That is secondary and can divide unnecessarily.
Yes.
And so I talked about what do I believe. And what I have found is that it still feels uncomfortable that I did that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also found that when I'm willing to say that, people start talking to me about their own spiritual lives. And so it ends up being something that binds us together as opposed to dividing, because far more people in our country, and I think in the world, but certainly in our country, are people who believe in a higher power,
mm-hmm.
in providence, in a divine being, but we all have collectively gone underground.
Right. And that is one of those interesting things. So one of the things we discussed before we came on is that I should talk a little bit about my own spiritual and religious background. I warned you it might not be that interesting, but I think that it is important to go on the
record. I will be the judge of that, as will your listeners.
So, as most folks know, sadly, my mother recently passed away. And she was, while not somebody who would attend church all the time, a woman of faith. And she was 100% always insistent on that. And so when I was growing up, you know, I had various children's Bibles and things like that. I've been reading the Bible since the time I was, you know, 6 or 7. So I was very familiar with the Bible and had gone to churches for weddings or funerals. But we never went to a church for a traditional service. There was no notion that I would go to a church every Sunday. What I had to do instead was to go to Chinese school and not have a chance to see any cartoons and do double the homework, which again seems terribly unfair, which is why I got out of that once I could. But I didn't have a frequent spiritual practice, and so it just never became a huge part of my life. Now, did I speak to divine providence and pray to God? Yes, absolutely. But, you know, the kind of prayer I did, this is embarrassing, but, you know, I would say, God, how about this lottery ticket that I'm going to get as a present? Could you make this one a winner? I'd like some more money. That would be good, God. Or God, you know, could you help for me to win this upcoming tournament or something like that? So it was a transactional kind of thing. And I will say that I've said my entire life that I am phenomenally lucky. And not just lucky in the sense that most people use the word lucky, which is to say, oh, I'm quite fortunate to have been born into these circumstances and I recognize my privilege and all these things. I'm like, no, I actually mean lucky. I actually mean things strangely work out for me and random things happen to make my life better. And so, you know, this, whether you call that luck or providence or fate, depends on your perspective. And so I always felt like I had a personal relationship because I was comfortable going to God and asking him, hey, you know, I have these books I'd like to buy. Can you send some money my way? But on the other hand, there was no formal training. And I actually deliberately avoid interrogating it. So if somebody asked me, do you believe in God? I'd say, well, I'm trying to leave that vague. I try to leave that not necessarily knowing. Because on the one hand, you know, as somebody who's really focused on science and the world around us and reality as it exists, I know that I cannot find specific evidence for the existence of providence, that all that exists can be explained by a series of physical laws and all these things that happen out there. But on the other hand, those physical laws are not in and of themselves complete. And there is no way for them to say that such divine providence does not exist. And there is the fact that my life is filled with endless luck and coincidence. It may also be that this is a manifestation of my overall optimism, right? Because as we know, optimists are luckier because they are looking for opportunities. They are more likely to seize upon them. They have better life outcomes. But even in dealing with my mother's passing and with the grief, I didn't seek consolation in religion and spirituality. I sought consolation instead in the notion of, you know, sort of the life that we lived and how it intersected with each other. I was very glad that my mother had faith, which I hope comforted her. But it wasn't something that I sought comfort from.
It's interesting. One of the questions that's coming up for me as you say that is, why do you deliberately avoid interrogating that? You're such a curious person. Yes. I find that interesting.
You know, if I were to guess, and I love the fact that you asked the question, because of course we discussed earlier, the instant you asked the question, an answer popped into my mind. Whether it is true or not, hard to say, but it's worth exploring. I think that the reason I deliberately avoid interrogating it is if I spent the time to think about it rationally, if I turned all the apparatus of analysis onto it, what I would say is I cannot prove that divine providence exists, and therefore I cannot in good conscience say that I believe. But if I don't interrogate it, then I leave the door open.
So what came for me is the question of, do you not interrogate it because you don't actually want to know?
And I think that's exactly it, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to know because I have an answer that I think I will come to, and I don't necessarily want to go with that answer.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, so what I find is interesting, I remember having a conversation with someone not too long ago, who said, I don't want to ask because I think I know the answer, and it will be that God does actually exist.
Oh, really?
And then what will that mean for me in terms of the responsibility? Like, once I know something, right, if I'm a person of honor, it's incumbent upon me to ask act on that. So I think it's interesting. You're like, I don't want to ask because I'm afraid the answer will be he doesn't exist. And I'm like, well, maybe you don't want to ask because you're afraid that he does.
Well,
it's funny.
So that is funny because that person has exactly the opposite feeling.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have ever watched the Apple TV Plus television show, Ted Lasso.
I have not.
It's a very popular television mm-hmm. show. There is one character on the show, interesting figure, one of the people who goes through a cycle of change and growth over the course of the show. But at one point in time, he's asked, would you rather be a lion or a panda? And his response is, neither. Why would I ever want to be something other than me?
Oh,
and
so good.
The comment on it is, wow, I'm not sure if you realize just how healthy that is. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel that learning definitively the existence or non-existence of divine providence would change my behavior one bit.
Huh. Oh, I love that. That's a great metaphor.
I live my life the way I do, mm-hmm. and I make the choices that I do, and I generally feel pretty confident in the choices. I know that I may be wrong sometimes, but if I feel like I should do this, then I do it. And if I feel like I don't want to do this, I'm like, okay, well, what's your reason for not wanting to do that? Is it a good reason? Ultimately, everything is our choice.
Mm.
And so it's one of these funny things. One of the reasons why I write nonfiction as opposed to fiction is that it is difficult to be a great fiction writer if you are almost always happy and rarely feel negative emotions.
Mm.
Writing, as I think it's Tolstoy said, happy families are all alike. And the fact is, one of my writing teachers once said, there's just not a lot of people out there who want to watch a television show called Village of the Happy Nice People. And even television shows, which are known for positivity, so a show like Ted Lasso or another show I think people talked about recently is Schitt's Creek, which is a Canadian comedy, or Kim's Convenience, all these various shows. They are shows where the stakes tend to be lower, but at the same time, there is still conflict.
There's tension.
There is still tension.
Yeah.
And so I think that, but it's a very different sort of thing. It's not literary fiction, if you will.
Yeah, what I appreciate about what you just shared is that you feel that you are living a life of integrity.
Right.
And that's what's important. Because that's a life of honor.
Exactly. And coming back to Clay, mm-hmm. who was not as direct an influence on my life, because I didn't work for him for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
but was still an influence, both because of course, his very famous book, The Innovator's Dilemma, which was the most important management book in the world for quite some time, and it certainly was so when I was at Harvard Business School, which is how I knew Clay,
mm-hmm.
because I met Clay at HBS, and we interacted, and I even interviewed him for the student paper, and other things like that. And that was something admired. And I would say that when I was younger, I didn't always act on what I felt that I should do.
Mm.
I was more likely to go along with what was expected, as opposed to doing what I thought I should do.
But as one does, tends to do when one is younger.
Because we're young, because, we're finding our way.
Exactly.
But seeing people like Clay, who were role models, mm-hmm. helped me figure out, okay, here's how I actually want to live my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the things, I think people obviously know Clay's name, but not everyone has seen him. And I think you described it, he is a giant of a man.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has passed on. But mm-hmm. he was 6'8", I believe,
mm-hmm.
and this was also, as I describe it, a gentle giant
mm-hmm.
in his demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Here was one of the most famous management thinkers in the world, a professor at Harvard Business School, the most prestigious business school in the world. He was the superstar of the school. He was also, at the time I was there, working very closely with the administration of the school on so many different things with Kim Clark, with Steve mm-hmm. Wheelwright, who incidentally were also all members of the faith,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the things I noticed when I was at business school. I'm like, this is also a good way to develop the hand on the tiller
mm-hmm.
to steer the future generations.
Mm-hmm.
But despite all these things, these very prestigious, amazing accomplishments. He always came across soft-spoken, humble, never trying to impress people with his words, mm-hmm. always seeking instead to understand.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, he really was.
So we exist in this world of intellect and corporations and startups and all these different things. And the subject of faith often doesn't come up. And we've talked about, you know, the hiding of faith. Mm-hmm. But let's turn it around and look at the other side of it, which was, how does faith power what you do? How does it help you accomplish what you accomplish? How does it motivate mm-hmm. and prompt and energize?
Yeah, such a great question. I think the simple answer is, it is my operating system. It animates everything that I do. When I think about, I remember having an interesting conversation with Bob Proctor a few years ago. Mm. And Bob Proctor, for those of you who don't know, he died recently as well, and very much part of the human potential movement, in many respects kind of a precursor to a Tony Robbins, a generation ahead of him. And he ended up being a mentor for me for a few years before he passed away. And I remember having a conversation with him, and when he found out, he's like, so, you know, what faith are you? And I said, you know, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he said, oh, you already have a purpose then. Which I thought was fascinating, yes. Because so much of the work that he does is, well, what's your purpose? What are you trying to get done? And he's like, oh, well, then if this is, you know what animates you. And so what animates me is I think about, how can I, as a human being, fill the measure of my creation? How can I reach my potential? Mm. And when I am at my best, how am I helping people around me reach there? And there are also some underlying principles that go with that, which is, growth is our default setting, that we are wired to grow and change. And people say, well, I don't know. And I'm like, have you ever seen a two-year-old who, when they fall down, does not get back up? They want to walk. It is wired in us. And that is what we desire as well. And so when we stop growing, when we stop changing, it's because something has happened that's made us believe it's not possible, which goes back to the growth and fixed mindset that we've been discussing. So that's what animates me, is that sense of, these are true ideas that we all want to grow, and how do I help make that happen in my corner, in my pocket of the world, within my sphere of influence? And so for me, it feels very much like a mission. It feels like a calling of, how do I put ideas, how do I put content, how do I show up in a way that helps people feel like growth is possible for them, that change is possible for them, that regardless of the situation you're in, you can make meaning of this, you can overcome it. And back to this idea of disruption, when we are moving in an environment where disruption is, we are afloat, we are awash in disruption, the only way through that is to disrupt ourselves.
I could not agree more. And I think that, you know, it suddenly becomes clear to me why it is that you do what you do. Because what you are really doing is, you're giving people the tools to be able to change. Mm-hmm. And there are many different tools. Like, we often think of tools as like being worksheets or software. But fundamentally, it's about sort of understanding yourself. Right? Without that self-understanding, you don't give yourself the permission to change. I think that's absolutely fascinating. By the way, we're going to, later on today, watch a TEDx talk that I recently gave. And afterwards, you and I should talk, because I think that there is a beautiful sort of intersection mm-hmm. between what I'm hoping that I and my collaborator, co-author, and friend Reid Hoffman will work on next in terms of books, and what you've been working on this whole time.
Mm.
So that will be a tease for a future conversation.
Listen up, everyone.
So I think about what you've just sort of described. And so how often does that come to mind? Like, as you go about your day, how frequently is there a reminder of your faith, or how frequently do you remember or recollect that purpose?
Not as often as I would like. I definitely, in the morning, read or listen to scripture or sacred text, and then I also have an app. It's called the Streaking app, which is kind of a silly name, but
to make sure you do it every day.
Yeah, it's actually really helpful. But I also, you know, like right now we're studying the New Testament, so it's been really wonderful to study about Christ's life. Mm-hmm. But then I also have some prompts of things to just remind me of, you know, I am a daughter of God. So we talked, or I don't know if we talked about this, but it was in my head, of this idea of identity, just reminding myself of who I am. I'm a daughter of God, or, and you know, Jesus is the living water. Just things that, you know, we talk about affirmations, right, things that help me ground myself in my identity. I also do a lot of work around, and this has been something more recent, and actually one thing I think is so wonderful about the time that we live in right now is that there are a lot of things that I believe from a faith perspective, but don't always know how to operationalize that.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons I loved Bob Proctor's work. That's one of the reasons I love, I've been studying, you know, the positive intelligence from Shirzad Shamin. One of the things I love about being here is that it's helping us do work around, how do I manage my emotions? How do I be grounded in my body? Because we can have these things that we believe about God, but we also have all this wiring that happened right from when we were really little, that it doesn't necessarily serve us. And so I love being in this work because we're able to give people tools that can help change their mind, change their heart, so that they can actually change, because we act from a place of our subconscious. So we can use our brain to reprogram our subconscious so that we
That's
can be
right
different. Anyway, so I love this work because it allows, it's that secular and that spiritual, you put them together and you can move forward.
That is, that's something that I think the people who are taking in your work, who are reading the books or hearing you speak, what's fascinating to me is the spiritual element of it may not be explicit, mm-hmm, but it is the subtext behind it all.
When I do it well.
Yes.
And that's been interesting for me is, you know, as I think about speaking in my speaking career, I have noticed that my speeches, when I try to, so I can have intellectually rigorous content, mm-hmm, but I am not effective when I stay in my head.
Right.
I'm only effective when I'm actually really willing to say, to cry, or I mean not ugly cry, but like to feel emotion.
Exactly, because we human beings, we all know about motor mirror neurons, we all know about the interaction between human beings. I say this in my speaking all the time. People are like, wow, thank you. I really enjoyed that talk. And I'm like, thank you, because I enjoyed it too. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't enjoy it, I didn't love it, you guys would pick up on that.
Ah, I love that. Right. If you're loving it, they're gonna feel it.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and so that willingness to go to that place of feeling and emotion, that's what allows us. And the reality is that if we don't feel something, we won't be inspired to change. We won't be motivated to change. We have to feel first, and then we get the tools to make the progress.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question that people sometimes ask me, and then I'll also find my answer quite boring, but it is still an interesting question. The question is, what's next? So you are a disciple of growth, mm-hmm, change, of adaptation. What growth or change or adaptation are you looking for in your own life?
Well, if I answered none, then that would be like hypocrisy alert, right?
Which is my problem. People ask me, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do next? And my answer is, well, pretty much more of the same. Can't we just keep doing that?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I'm a big fan of Brandon Sanderson, the fantasy writer.
Oh, yes, I'm a big fan of Brandon as well. Ironically, I've never read his work, but I have listened to the podcast he helped found, Writing Excuses, for many, many years. Brandon Sanderson, Dan Wells, Howard Taylor, Mary Robinette Kowal, and a host of others. And it is one of the writing podcasts I've listened to religiously.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, you should read the Mistborn series. It's really good. But one of the things he said is, a hypocrite is a person who's in the process of changing. It's not always true, but sometimes it is. So to your question of what's next, one of the things that's important to me, because I believe that this idea set that we have can be so useful to people, and we've seen it be useful to people, is to be on this growth curve of building and scaling a business. Mm. So there are many people in our world who, you know, they'll write a book and they speak, and that's good. They're good with right. that. But as I said, I'm on a mission. And so we are in the process of, we have a certification program where it's ICF accredited. So you can get 40 credits for getting certified in our smart growth framework. And then we also have a tool that we're developing, a technology tool that allows you to, I think of it as an engagement tool on steroids, because it allows you to see, do I perceive that there continues to be growth upside for me in this org? And if there's not a growth upside, I'm not engaged. If there is, I am. And then also looking at what tools of self-disruption are you using to grow? And then the ecosystem. To what extent is this ecosystem making it possible for me to grow? And how am I contributing to this ecosystem? Which is, I almost said, sumamente importante, because we're in Mexico.
So yes,
Spanish came out. And so I have a co-founder. Her name is Amy Humble. She was the chief of staff for Jim Collins. So kind of like Jim Collins and Clay Christensen putting it together, the love child, if you will. And if we did love childs, which I don't. But anyhow, that sounded a little funny, but you get my point. So we're in the
synthesis.
We'll call it the synthesis. That word just came out. But we're in the process of, how do we scale? How do we build and scale a business? Mm. Which is really exciting, because yes, I love to speak, and yes, I love my podcast, and I love to coach. But what is it like to build not only people, but build a business?
No, and we will talk more about that, because we're in a similar boat, and I love speaking, and I love going around the world, and I love writing, I love doing those things, but I needed to do more, which is why there is Blitzscaling Ventures and why we've been growing that. And so I think we're on a similar journey. Of course, I'm really focused on scaling up businesses, so we will talk more.
On Blitzscaling businesses.
Now, it is traditional in a podcast to make sure that we also include a plug of some kind. So, Whitney, what would you like to plug? Where can people find out about you? Where can they subscribe or follow, or whatever it is that you want them to do? And where can they get your books and other items that they could purchase, perhaps?
Well, obviously, you can get the books on Amazon, so that's easy. The most recent one is Smart Growth. I think the one that many people know very well is Disrupt Yourself. You can listen to our podcast. Chris, you've been a guest on the podcast.
Yes, it's a wonderful podcast. Whitney does a fantastic job as a host.
Thank you.
As you can tell from her being a wonderful guest.
Thank you. And what's fun is that I actually connected with another guest who came on our podcast, Andre Menezes, because you are invested in his business.
I'm an investor and advisor to his business. A wonderful business. The company is called Next Gen Foods. They make a plant-based chicken substitute called Tyndall, which is both healthy and low cost, and hopefully improving sustainability of food across the world. Mm.
So that's how we connected. So an obvious place for people to connect is via our podcast. And I think those are great places to start. Obviously, if you want to have a more in-depth conversation, you can reach out to me at whitney@thedisruptionadvisors.com. But I think that is sufficient for now.
Well, as we have learned to say here at the Modern Elder Academy, we are complete.
We are complete.
And thank you, all of you, for joining us on this journey. I think that it's a little different than the conversations you typically have, Whitney, but that's why I wanted to have it.
Mm. It was lovely, so thank you.
My pleasure. And everyone, please listen up. There will be more great content coming soon. And you know what they say on podcasts, rate, review, subscribe, blah, blah, blah. Try to do all that as well. I'm Chris Yeh, and thank you for listening.